From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on November 11th, last year, just about 1 year ago. Remember when there were still 17 candidates in the Republican primary? They debated in two tiers on that night in November, and in the main tier you had two of the frontrunners going head-to-head, Donald Trump and Ben Carson. Maybe it feels like a lifetime ago. Now, Trump made a comment about taxes and about wages. He said that both were too high in this country. It was, to say the least, a comment that raised some questions, because the narrative and the reality has been that wages for the middle and working classes have stagnated. So too high in wages? When would the growth come? Well, maybe we're finally seeing an answer. Investigative journalist David K. Johnston has a new analysis out in an article entitled Good News, Long-Awaited Wage Growth is Finally Happening. And I asked him to come in here for the hour and explain what his analysis has found when it comes to wages. We're going to get a little wonky in the numbers, but I think we're going to try to relate it to the narratives that we've been hearing and what we can expect going forward. And David is my guest here in studio, and you've got a lot of charts in front of you, my friend.
Marshall, a lot of paperwork.
Marshalling a lot of data.
For what I write.
Great to have you. Thank you for being here, David. You know, David's also the author of The Making of Donald Trump, and I would be remiss if I didn't at least say, I know you heard a lot of the last hour. That was one of those hours where I could not possibly get through all of the phone calls, the emails, the tweets, and the feedback from listeners who wanted to weigh in on Trump as sort of the de facto Christian choice in the eyes of Eric Metaxas. You've written a lot about this, so I'd be remiss if I didn't let you weigh in on that. Go ahead.
Well, only that in my book, The Making of Donald Trump, I quote Trump at great length in different forums over long periods of time where he is consistent in his total rejection of Christianity. So he goes around saying, I'm Christian, but he calls people who follow the teachings of Jesus Christ fools, idiots, and schmucks. And in the third case, he's not being redundant. He means the more vile meaning of that word in Yiddish. Hearing the thoughtful remarks of the three pastors you had, I thought was terrific.
Okay. And are you surprised that we've come this far, David, where you have a number of Christian leaders and hold on, let me back up and just, I'm going to say this again because our pastors were adamant about this, and they're right. We cannot talk about Christianity as a monolith. You can't talk about any religion as a monolith. You can't talk about atheism as a monolith. When I say some Christian leaders, I don't mean all, I don't mean most, but look at Jerry Falwell and the battle he's had with students at Liberty University. Look at others. Are you surprised to see some people of that ilk still standing with Trump saying, you know, we trust him as a great Christian?
Well, you raise something I think is a very troubling issue in our society. There are lots of people who are actual Christians and who follow the teachings of the New Testament. It's the people who are the modern-day Pharisees who are on television, who wear fine clothes and have private jets and whatnot, to whom this is a business, often a business designed to promote racism and hatred, that are the problem. And those are the people I call faux Christians. And it's very important that we not lump together people who are actual believers or who conduct themselves with a life of caring and compassion and love with people who have distorted that message. And in that sense, they're no different than the people in the Muslim world who are behind ISIL. If you read their publications, they are very similar. The end of the world is coming. It's coming momentarily. It's going to come at a place called Dabiq, which, by the way, they no longer control, which is a bit of a theological problem for them. But they're apostates. And I would argue that the people who are not Christians, what I call the faux Christians, they're apostates who love money and who, the gospel seemed pretty clear that God would like you to be well off, to prosper, but the better, more you prosper, the greater your duty to care for others, and they don't teach that half of the message.
All right, let's talk about his column. And I did want to start with a comment that Trump made, because when he made this comment about a year ago, it raised a lot of eyebrows about, wait a second, first of all, how do we feel about wages? What is the true story on where wages are, wage growth? We thought there was stagnation. Here you have a leading presidential contender saying wages were too high. Let's listen to that.
Taxes too high, wages too high. We're not going to be able to compete against the world. I hate to say it, but we have to leave it the way it is. People have to go out. They have to work really hard, and they have to get into that upper stratum. But we cannot do this if we are going to compete with the rest of the world. We just can't do it.
All right. That was about a year ago. Wages too high. I don't know. You've studied and covered a lot of Donald Trump. What did you make of that, David?
Well, I wasn't surprised he said that at all. I mean, remember, Donald Trump is a man who fought for 18 years to cheat illegal immigrants out of their $4 an hour pay. And today's money would be around $12.50 an hour. They were illegal immigrants from Poland. and he wouldn't pay them what they were due. They were so bad off that they, these men had nowhere to go. They slept in the middle of winter in the Bonwit Teller building in New York as they tore it down so that Trump Tower could be put up. And he cheated them out of that little amount of money. And he's been sued again and again and again by vendors, small businesses who've had some cases gone out of business, in other cases had to fire workers because he didn't pay them. And his own top manager, the Doral Golf Course down in near Miami, where Trump was yesterday, when asked why Trump hadn't paid a Benjamin Moore paint dealer the last $34,000 owed on the contract, said Mr. Trump feels he has paid enough. And so not only does Trump think wages are too high, but even when he pays far below market wages, he cheats people whenever he can out of their due. And by the way, if there's anything that the Old Testament and the New are very clear on, and there's lots of scripture about, it's you pay workers their due, they earned it.
Well, I think I wanted to start there because I think that confused some people who are watching in two regards. First of all, are wages actually going up? And this was a year ago now, and the data that David has been looking at is pretty current. But the question a year ago was, are wages actually finally going up? And then is that a good thing or is that not a good thing? How does that compare with wages at the very top of the scale, for example? David, you've been looking into all of that.
Right.
So the narrative has said stagnation, big wage gap. What do we know?
And I'm partly responsible for that narrative. I mean, I was at the New York Times every year. I wrote about it.
Sometimes we use narrative pejoratively.
Yeah.
But this, in this case, the narrative has reflected the actual facts. But now the facts, you said, are showing something else. What are they showing?
Well, wage growth began in 2013. And let me point out, that's the year that was the end of the Bush-era tax cuts for the top 1%. Wages, the median wage and the average wage grew in 2013. The rate of growth for the median, that's half make more, half make less, tripled in 2014, and it more than tripled again in 2015. Now, from 2000 through 2014, even with those 2 years of increases in 2013 and 14, the total wage growth in 2014 compared to the year 2000 was $6 a year for the median, the middle point, $6 a year. In 2015, it went up $1,074, and the last 3 years combined come to over $1,500, or more than 5%. When we see the data for 2016, it's going to show even higher figures and continued growth. We're seeing the number of jobs grow. We've had 79 months of private sector job growth. That is unprecedented. The longest previous period was 52 months. 79 months of private sector job growth, 15.3 million jobs added. That's more than all of Europe and Canada combined. And they're not all bad-paying jobs either. Now, the data that I'm relying on here is the very, very best data the government has. It comes from the Social Security Administration. It's used for all the other government reports. And it's used to check your tax return. Every employer's W-2 statement that you get is also sent to Social Security. They add it up to the penny, and they slice and dice it every year. And every year, I analyze that data. And I'm the only person in America who does so. I don't understand why, but I'm the only person who publishes anyway. There's no economist or journalist except me who does this. And at the high end, the data shows that the big growth was in jobs that pay over $50 million a year. From 2014 to 15, the number of those jobs, Evan, went up more than 50% to 202 jobs. It's not very many jobs, from 134 to 202 jobs. And the average pay went up $5 million to $91 million in that category. And to give an idea of that, this tiny group, 202, that's about 1 in 800,000 people with a job, but they get 1 in every $400 of pay.
Okay. And so on that score, I think a lot of listeners are going to hear that and think, wait a second, is David saying that wage growth is almost entirely attributable to the top?
Right. And the reason I start off with the median, half make more and half make less, is that there's significant wage growth going on among people in all the smaller categories. The lowest category the government measures is a penny to $5,000, and then 5 to 10, 10 to 15, et cetera. The numbers of jobs are rising. The average pay is rising. We have fewer people below $15,000 a year. On the other hand, just to be clear, so 50% of workers make $29,930 less. $30,000 or less is the halfway point in jobs. 13% make less than $5,000. Those are people who have casual jobs. Maybe they're students, somebody who works perhaps just for a few days at the holidays. You get into full-time work at about $15,000. Well, about one quarter of all workers, more than a quarter, almost 30%, make less than $15,000. And yet those people's numbers and pay are going up. And when you get into 30, 40, 50, 60, 80, $100,000 jobs, there's a lot of growth.
I know the phones are starting to ring. If you've got questions about the specifics, and again, as I promised you, as Malcolm Gladwell has greatly said, numbers can be great and numbers can be overwhelming in a radio format. But number one, I would encourage you to read David's article, and we've posted it on Twitter and we'll put it in various places so you can find it. That kind of takes us through the wage growth. But if you've got questions, this is a great chance to do that. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. David, in the piece, in noting the growth at the top, you make the point that the growth is not only at the top, but for the growth at the top, it sort of kind of takes apart some of the, the justifications that executives or those at the top make for they need to make more because X, Y, and Z. Can you get into that?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely fascinating. The number of jobs paying more than $2 million in this country actually shrank during the period from 2000 up to 2012. It started growing again. But it really took off after the higher tax rates went into effect in 2013 and then 14 and now 15. So there are two ways to think about this. Either tax rates don't have the negative effect we think, or, and this is a more cynical view, executives who make over $50 million a year, and that's who most of these people are making over $50 million, have enough power within the companies to say, you got to raise my pay enough to cover the taxes. And by the way, the average amount that the pay of these folks went up just about equals the additional tax burden that they would face. So
draw your own conclusions.
Yeah.
With that. Okay.
One other thing about why people, before we get to calls, if you don't mind.
Yep.
It's important to understand that back in 2000, George W. Bush promised that if his tax plan was enacted, we'd all be better off. And in October of that year, when I was at the New York Times, I called the campaign and said, well, you know, you guys are running ads and you're saying on the campaign trail we're going into the Al Gore recession, which we were. So I said, don't you want to hedge your bet a little bit? You know, might be a couple of years and then we'll be better off. This was taken as a very hostile question. And the answer I got was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the guy said, when's your story going to appear? And at that moment, I realized he was thinking in campaign terms about right then. And I said, in about 10 years when we have the data. So every year I have tracked the data. Here's the shocking fact that people should know. The average American household has made $55,000 less money from 2000 through 2001 through 2014 than if we had stayed at the level of the year 2000. Now, that money clearly wasn't evenly distributed, but $55,000 a household is enough money to pay off every student loan in America, every car loan in America, every credit card debt in America, pay all the income and payroll taxes on it, and people would have more than $20,000 left in the bank. The fact is, the numbers show that the promise, lower tax rates on people at the top especially, and you will be better off, is not what happened. It didn't create growth. And now you're seeing Wall Street this week, the Wall Street Journal writing about it this week, that Wall Street is saying, you know, what we need to have growth in this country is we've got to go and invest on our infrastructure, which we have neglected for years. It creates jobs, it makes commerce more efficient, it lowers the cost of distribution of goods and services and makes the economy therefore run more smoothly. Not good news for people who are in the front-end alignment business or the towing wrecks business, but good news for everybody else.
I read people like Bruce Bartlett, Reagan's former budget guy, who has said, look, even as a fiscal conservative, I can tell you that what we know is supply side or the pejorative trickle-down hasn't worked.
Right.
And Bruce Bartlett has said, what is it going to take to kill this chimera that's out there that always rears its head that's the way to growth? And again, I'm not trying to take sides. I'm an evidence guy, as we say on this show. Bartlett is a Reagan guy who says it hasn't worked. But why do we still hear it 20, 30 years later, Dave?
Well, because there are people who benefit from this. The fact is that if you, 12.5% of the Bush tax cuts went to 1 in 1,000 people at the top. And the less they pay in taxes, the more they therefore have after tax. They can invest that money. the greater their wealth becomes. The real problem we have is that we have piled up so much at the very top that people can't productively invest it. The analogy I use is Adam Smith started out studying the circulatory system of the body. Well, if your venal and arterial blood flows are out of whack, blood will start to gather somewhere, the lowest place when you sit down. And that leads to bad health. Ultimately, the blood rots. It'll kill you. We have to have money that's in circulation. And we're all better off when the middle class is better off, when jobs pay better.
And when the working class is better off.
And the working class is better off because people – and we're better off if we got rid of student debt. One of the reasons our economy is in trouble is when I went to college in the 60s and the 70s, at least where I lived in California, college was free. Now we have people who are in debt, and I know people whose hair has turned gray and they're still in debt from college. That means they didn't have as much money to spend buying houses, filling those houses with furniture, having children, and all the spending that goes with that stimulates the economy. Why? So that we could make virtually guaranteed profits for some bankers. One of the big lending companies, you know, bought a Gulfstream jet. And through their charity, and used it principally to fly members of the House and Senate committees that controlled the law on student debt around the country for free.
David K. Johnston, investigative journalist, is my guest, and you've got some great questions, I see. So let's go ahead and start working through them. Lydia in Penfield, first up. Go ahead, Lydia.
Yeah, I have a question. It seems to me that the problem isn't really unemployment as much as it's underemployment. I mean, I see a lot of people, when they work 40 or 50 hours a week, if they're cobbling together two, three, and four jobs, and that doesn't help them, and it may allow employers to not have to pay certain kinds of benefits.
Yeah. But Lydia, you're exactly right about that. We have a real serious problem with people who are underemployed and people who are not in full-time employment. I know someone who's the manager in another state of a large big box retailer, and he's only allowed to have, I think it's four full-time employees, maybe five, including him, and everybody else has to work 20 hours or less. So once a month, this guy goes down to the Waffle House with the managers of three other stores, and they work out the schedules of their employees so they can get them 40 hours a week of full time, and they can still do things like some of them go to school, some of them have children, they have to be home at certain hours. They're getting around the company's positions on this issue, and we would get rid of that issue if we had what every other modern country has, universal health insurance not tied to your job.
If people are underemployed, then why can't there be some kind of a mechanism for companies of a specific size to be able to make some kind of a litmus test of the percentage of their employees that have to be full-time?
Well, the government can do those things that way. I mean, I think we're better off if we set the market rules more broadly to encourage full-time employment, and the best way to do that is to get rid of employer-provided health care. And I say this as somebody who co-founded a little company, you know, only 25 workers, but nothing was more annoying to me than this issue of providing health care.
You're talking about single-payer.
Yes, you don't have to have it single-payer directly. You can do it in lots of different ways. But let me just give you an idea, and this is another numbers issue. If we had either the French or German systems, which are quite different and are quite excellent, the French have the best system in the world, every study shows, it would save so much money, and we would have 100% care in France with no out-of-pocket costs, in Germany with minimal ones. It would eliminate the income tax for 99.3% of Americans this year. 99.3%. Back in 2009, it would have completely eliminated the income tax. As the economy gets better, that'll dip down, but it's never going to go under 98-97% out of the income tax on a statistical basis. This is just a huge, wasteful, non-system system that is a huge drag on our economy. And you know, we need to give it up. And you can have single payer and still pick your own doctor. We can design the system in a lot of different ways. But right now, we have a system where physicians have to hire huge numbers of people to process paperwork. I mean, I assume everybody is like my household. If you have health insurance, you get all these forms in the mail and then an audit about this $3. I got one the other day for a $3.29 payment. you know, prove you made this payment. It's like, seriously?
For three, huh? That's an efficient thing for government to be hunting down. Matt Iglesias, writing for Vox.com, wrote about the rising premiums for Obamacare this week that are coming in 2017. And what he said was that this can be fixed if we have adults in the room who say it's not perfect, there are problems. The bigger problem that Iglesias sees is that the penalty for people who choose not to get coverage is not big enough because it's been watered down. We don't want to, and it incentivizes people to basically say, okay, I'd rather just pay the penalty than not get coverage, and therefore fewer healthy people are in that, and it's hurt.
But it's even worse than that, Evan, because one of the things that Lawrence O'Donnell and I separately pointed out within a day of each other was that there is no enforcement. One of the things Obama agreed to get the Affordable Care Act passed was if you don't pay your penalty, the government cannot force you to do so. It cannot attach your wages. It cannot.
They can strongly tell you.
All they can do is seize your refund. So if you don't overpay your taxes, you can escape the penalty. If you at the end of the year write the government a little check to make up whatever the tax difference is, you will never have to pay. And by the way, if we're going to add a lot of people who couldn't get health care because they had pre-existing conditions, surprise, surprise, we're going to have a bump up one time or two times in costs, and then we'll have a new plateau. We've delayed the Cadillac health care tax, which is on really fancy
which
plans.
Which everybody knew was going to get delayed because the government doesn't have the guts to go forward with that.
That's right. I mean, if you're a senior executive at a big company, even if there's copays and stuff, the company reimburses the money to you and on top of that gives you the money for the taxes on that, which is just another way of putting the executive's eyes thumbs in the eyes of the shareholders.
All right, so on the penalty, this is like the parent who's put the plate of dinner in front of the kid, but the dessert is already on the plate, and they're saying, I strongly suggest you have those Brussels sprouts before you eat the cookie, and the kid is looking at you just laughing, eating the cookie, saying, thank you for the suggestion, the cookie is delicious. I mean, can we change this? Can Obamacare be saved or improved? And do you see an outlet for this, or are you thinking, scrap it, start over, go towards something like a single payer?
Well, as a political reality, we're going to have to work on improving it and addressing these cost issues.
Yeah, single payer doesn't have a
because right now there isn't the public support for it. But let's remember something. Richard Nixon agreed in 1973 to universal public health care, and the only reason we don't have it is George Meany, who was the head of the FLCIO, got greedy and said, well, next year we'll get a better deal. And then Watergate came, and it never came about. It used to be leaders of big business in America in the early 70s were all in favor of going to a government plan for everybody. And the easiest way to do that would be drop the age of Medicare to zero and make it an option. And then if you want Medicare, you can do that. And then there'll be problems with Medicare. There'll be big problems that will turn up. But then you work on fixing those problems. But I don't see single payer in the near term. I think if we had a campaign to educate people, though, we're coming to the end of the age of Reagan, and it's not going to end with President Hillary Clinton. You know, as the joke on Saturday Night Live was, you can vote for the other guy or you can vote for the Republican, meaning her.
Yes, right.
But I think the demographics and stuff are coming that we have a shot at getting single payer health care within my lifetime.
Shauna in Rochester, next step. Go ahead, Shauna.
Hi, I was interested when you listed the categories of income earners. Do you have any measures to know about upward mobility? In other words, if there were some number of people who earned $15,000 last year, what are they earning this year?
Right. We do. Now, it's important in statistics to remember that, individuals are not the statistics, Shauna. For example, 2009 was a terrible year for the economy, but it was a great year for me personally. And what the data show is that there is a slow but steady for the last 3 years upward movement. And let me give you a good measure of that. At the $30,000 to $35,000 year salary level, the percentage of people has moved by about one percentage point. That is, in 2014, 51.5% of Americans made less than $30,000 at work. And the next year, even after you adjust for inflation, it's 50%.
Okay.
So it's a slow, steady improvement here of wages moving up. And that tells you there's more demand in the economy. But we still face fundamental problems about not having enough demand. I mean, employers, including myself when I was an employer, hire people when you need the work done. You don't hire people for a tax benefit. You don't hire people for anything except, oh, I have more work that needs to be done. Got to hire more people.
Sean, does that help?
Now, how does that compare to the days when the economy was going great in the upward mobility question?
The economy in this country has slowed down a lot. The wages of U.S. workers are now at the median level at a peak. But in 1973, we hit a median pay level and an average total income level for the bottom 90% that we didn't see again until just recently. And there are a number of reasons for that. One of them is as the boomers came of age and as they were growing up, their parents spent a lot of money on them. Kids are expensive. I could tell you as the father of eight. And
how many?
Yeah, eight.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. Then they went to college. They bought cars. They got married. They had their own kids. And then we had these structural changes that took place. You know, the steel industry in America did not modernize the way the destroyed steel industries of Japan and Germany did. So we lost a lot of that. And also, we began to become, especially in the early 80s, much more efficient with the use of both computers and molecules, things like making steel or drugs. And inefficiency creates jobs. Efficiency destroys jobs. So 1,000 years ago, if you wanted to make a ton of steel, which you made by taking wrought iron and having a guy with big, huge arms and shoulders pound carbon into that steel, it took multiple man years of work to produce one ton of steel. Today, a ton of steel requires less than 1 hour of labor. I remember going when I was in my early 20s into a sawmill. And there were hundreds of men working in this sawmill, and I wanted out of there real fast. I thought it was a terribly dangerous place to be. The sawmill in that community today employs 8 people, and that includes the secretary in the front of the office, because it's all computer-driven machinery.
Talking to David K. Johnston about wage growth in this country, his article, we've posted it in a number of places, Good News, Long-Awaited Wage Growth is Finally Happening, based on his analysis of up-to-date data. And that certainly sort of throws a curveball at the narrative. So let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with your phone calls and get more of your questions in via email, including Richard, by the way, David, who wants to know, please ask David K. Johnston, is he writing an ongoing column for any paper or magazine? It would be good to follow him and his work somewhere beyond his books.
Yep. I write a column every week that appears both at Investopedia.com and at the Daily Beast.
Daily Beast and Investopedia. His newest book is The Making of Donald Trump, which we've discussed. He's got a pile of others. And we'll continue the discussion on wage growth, including some of his thoughts on if we have enough to draw conclusions about why. You know, sometimes if you're coaching a basketball team, you can go in and you can watch a guy shoot free throws, and if he's bricking shot after shot, you can work with him on technique. It doesn't always work like that when it comes to economic policy, because it's like the ball freezes halfway in the air, and then you have to decide if it was a good idea or not, and then you have an election, and then you have to see if the ball ends up going through the hoop. Well, David is giving us a chance to see where that ball is now, and it turns out it may be a little bit more online than we thought, but we're going to talk about why when we come back in just a moment. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. First hour, why do so many of us believe things that are blatantly untrue? Why do we choose to ignore factual evidence, particularly in light of elections? And how might we change that? That's our discussion first hour. Second hour, candidates for the New York State Assembly. In the wake of the death of Bill Nogé, we talk to the Republican and the Democrat in that race. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You can also see us right now, by the way, on City 12. Hello, if you're watching on City 12 in the city of Rochester. I always meet people who say, oh, that's what you look like. And I say, yes, it's just typical male pattern baldness. But you can see us, hello, every Wednesday at 1 o'clock, and the great team at City 12 putting that on. Maybe you're listening on the mobile app. But wherever you're listening, we're talking to David K. Johnston. And what I want to do is, before I get back to your phone calls, I want to hit that question on if we know why wage growth is happening. Well, two questions, David. Yeah. First of all, there's still a gap, isn't there? I mean, when we talk about the wage gap, this doesn't mean the gap is closed and it's sort of egalitarian paradise.
Right. No, not at all. From 2000 to 2012, the 7% of workers who made $100,000 to $400,000 a year in 2012, 7% of the workforce, they got 77% of all the increased wages. Now, the number of people in that group went up a lot, and their pay went up. And that group is essentially people who have advanced educations, people who are servants to the wealth class, bankers, tax people, accounting people. In a few places, it may be, you know, senior detectives or high-level nurses. But by and large, these are people who have significant educations. And during that same period, 2000-2012, the number of jobs that paid over $2 million a year fell significantly. It fell like about 5%, and the average pay about 4%. So that class had a 9% decline. That's now reversing. People who have unskilled or semi-skilled jobs, they're in deep trouble, and they're going to continue to be in deep trouble. And unlike, say, the Germans, we have not instituted policies to insulate and protect those people. The Nordic countries have addressed this problem. In Denmark, if you lose your job because the factory work you did is no longer needed, you get 90% of your pay, provided that you go to a job training program or even an education program. If they said, oh, gee, Evan, you know what? Radio is no longer around. You should get a PhD in philosophy. They'll pay for you to get your PhD. Once you get it, the government will find you one job. If you don't take it, it'll find a second job. And if you don't take that, your benefits are cut 90%. So you're getting 9% of your original pay, which means people find their own jobs after their job training. And, you know, you don't see any beggars in the street in Denmark and Sweden and Norway. People live pretty nice lives. They live in nice houses. They have nice cars. And they have superb public transit, especially trains.
Okay. Now, when it comes to that gap, then, it still exists. Your analysis shows, at the very least, we're starting to see wage growth at all levels?
Pretty much. There's a few anomalies, but I think they're anomalies. And if I were to rebunch the data, they would disappear.
Is there enough evidence to show us why this is happening?
Well, economic theory tells us why it's happening. As more people get hired, we've added these 15.3 million jobs. They have more money to spend. That creates more demand. What creates more jobs is a demand for work. So if people don't have any money, you're not going to have demand. But if people are now buying cars, we've had very large sales of cars in recent years as the automobile fleet has aged. They're buying furniture. They're creating families and having children. That creates new jobs. Now, some jobs are going to shrivel and disappear and go away, and the wages are going to fall, and other jobs are going to grow. We've also seen some significant changes in gender pay. Overall, women still make significantly less than men, but in certain occupations, women now are being hired at higher wages initially and seem to be on a track to be doing better, particularly law.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. And this is John in Rochester next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, David.
Hi there.
You know, I have to say, I agree with you on a couple different things. One thing for sure, I think the most of the people in the country are getting squeezed by big corporations. There's no doubt about it. They're taking advantage of their financial power. But on the other side of it, I think government also is a villain in this. Government and huge corporations. But my question to you is this. I look at it a little differently. I think real trickle-down economics is what's being perpetrated by the Keynesian method that's being used really today to get the economy going. And the reason I say that, the more you take out of the private sector and put it in the hands of the government resources to then distribute it back down, that's really trickle-down economics. And it's ultimately going to fail. I'll give you an example. Solar City in Buffalo. They're going to spend $750 million for the government's going to spend on that facility. And in the short run, it will produce jobs. People will produce jobs, et cetera. But eventually, I think that project will fail because the substance behind the corporation, will fail, and eventually those jobs will dissipate. So
John, let me see if I can address your thinking here, okay? First of all, you know, I wrote a whole book about all these subsidies that are given to companies called Free Lunch, and a second book about indirect subsidies called The Fine Print. On the other hand, it is only because of the subsidies that taxpayers put into mathematics, materials science, chemistry, and physics before World War II that we have the economy we do today. About 35% of our economy today can be traced back to taxpayer spending, which at the time would have been seen and was written about as being scandalous, that led to scientific advances. And that's because companies don't do basic research. They do applied research.
Can I respond?
Yeah.
I was just going to mention, because sometimes my time is going to be limited, and I understand that. The fact is, I believe we have some wage growth. There's no doubt about it. But look at the deficit national debt has grown almost will double since in the last 8 years, and that's partially driving the wage growth, but that can't last forever. And that's okay. Where I bring up the Solar City example. In the short run, that government taxation and government taking resources from the private sector can work in the short run. Right. But in the long run, you're going to run up a national debt of $20 trillion. We've doubled it in the last 7 years, and it will continue to double if we keep this philosophy going. We've got to get the hands. We got to get the money in the hands of the private sector.
John, I got you. Let me just point out.
Go ahead.
The economy doesn't care if an investment is made by private individuals or by the government. That's why the Wall Street people are now saying we are shorting the economy by not investing in Commonwealth goods and services. If you're in the hotel business, that's the business my son and I got into. We don't own a hotel. He now manages a hotel. People can't get to us if we don't have roads and highways. Conrad Hilton wrote about this at great length many years ago, the great hotelier, about how dependent his business was on both peace and civil infrastructure. And so what we've done now for a number of years is shortchanged public investment in education, basic science, and most importantly, perhaps in the short run, infrastructure. And whether that money is spent by the private sector or the public sector is immaterial. When you build roads, you hire people, and you hire lots of skilled people, like people with engineering degrees, to do work. There are economies that have a much larger share spent on taxpayer services than ours that are doing just fine. The real problem is the upward redistribution of wealth and income to the top, where people at the very top have far more than they can put any practical use to, and they can't even invest the money well anymore. Whereas at the bottom, people are liquidity constrained, income constrained, and asset constrained.
Before we go back to the phones, two follow-ups to John's points that he was talking about. David, I am not an economist. I found it strange to compare trickle-down to Keynesian theory. Keynesian is almost definitionally the opposite, where it's sort of a middle-out or a bottom-up, as opposed to sort of concentrating either wealth or benefits at the top and hoping it flows
downward. Let me explain what Keynes is, very simply. One of the most basic things you learn in economics, and we forget, are something called accounting identities. They are always true. 1 + 1 is always 2 as long as you're in base 10. Well, the economy is private spending and government spending together, okay? So if you reduce private spending when we have a recession, Keynes says, well, you make up for that by increasing government spending. We should, therefore, when the economy is really booming, cut back on government spending, and instead we tend to increase government spending. We do the opposite of what we should do. When the economy is booming, we should pay down debt.
Which is what happened under George W. Bush, by the way, right?
Yes. Oh, no, that's right. George W. Bush, in terms of what's called the discretionary federal budget, was the biggest spender of all time, more than LBJ.
With a Republican Congress.
Yes, with a Republican Congress. And that's because we have allowed these ideas that don't actually stand up very well to influence our economy. And then the upside to this, the Chicago School, and I went to the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Economics for 2 quarters on a fellowship. The Chicago School theories that have led to all of this, they are systematically being taken apart by behavioral economists, and study after study after study showing that, yeah, this looks great on paper, but when we look at the real world, we can design experiments and show empirical data that people don't behave as pure, rational, economic, mathematical models. They actually have emotions. They make mistakes. They have different ideas than the Chicago School imagines. And so if we want to have a wealthy economy, we've got to invest in Commonwealth goods and services. And, you know, my next book is I'm drafting an entirely new federal tax code, and it will encourage much more savings by everybody, not just people at the top.
And then, by the way, John, I would say when you talk about Keynesian economics, you can go back to 2009 and you can go back to the stimulus package. Republicans were in favor of their own stimulus package. It was slightly smaller than what the Democrats and President Obama wanted and got. And then Republicans can say, well, look, you just overspent. Very few people were in favor of austerity there. And that could be a whole other discussion, austerity versus Keynesian. Right. We're not going to do that now. I don't want to bore the entire audience. But the point is, it's a little bit of, there's a lack of genuine honesty debate when it comes to this idea that, well, it was only one party that wanted a Keynesian package in 2009. It's not true. And some, Krugman and others, wanted it bigger. But the bottom line is...
Because the math said it should be bigger. I mean, we could determine exactly how big it should be. And we wasted a big part of the stimulus package on tax cuts for small businesses, which are inherently savings instead of spending.
Okay, one other point to John, though. He brought up SolarCity.
Yes.
Republicans often, and I understand why, bring up Solyndra, or maybe they've heard me and others talk about corn-based ethanol, another sort of swing and misses with government picking winners and losers. And I understand that frustration. I think the SolarCity story has not been written yet. I understand why there's doubts or concerns about it. But, David, what's the message to people like John who say, I can point to Solyndra, I can point to other big government investments that have failed, and I want government out of the game entirely?
Well, if you want to make that argument, fine. What will happen is China will continue to subsidize those kinds of industries. And lo and behold, what we're seeing is that the Chinese are pulling way ahead of us in things like renewable energies, and they're going to get the profits. Same thing with drugs. There are leading drug researchers who have left the United States and gone to China and India because their governments will finance the research. We're not. And that means that the hundreds of billions and maybe trillions of dollars of future profits won't be here in the U.S. They'll be in those countries, which is good for those countries, but kind of penny-wise and pound-foolish here.
Talking to David K. Johnston, investigative journalist, who is out with his new analysis of wage growth, showing real wage growth at most levels of income earners for the first time in a long time. What's the short summary before I go back to the phones? If you've missed it earlier, the wage growth summary is what?
Wage growth started in 2013. It tripled in 2014, and it more than tripled again in 2015. And when we get the 2016 data in a year, it will show significantly more wage growth. From 2000 to 2014, even with those 2 years of growth, the net increase was $6 a year for the middle worker, the median worker. The next year, $1,074. $6 after 14 years, $1,074 after 1 year.
Bud and Chilai, next up. Go ahead, Bud.
Well, thank you. First of all, I want to commend Mr. Johnston and the book. I really found that fantastic.
Which book, Bud? He's got lots of books.
The Making of Donald Trump.
Thank you.
The whole family has a history of this kind of behavior. Well, aside from that, I wanted to say you're picking up the flag of Noam Chomsky from MIT, who basically has a movie now you can watch on Netflix. I forget the name of it, but it's it really goes and completely discusses the transfer from manufacturer to banking. And as we do so, we reward people who are in banking, insurance, and blah, 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 those kind of industries, and we cut out manufacturing. What I'm wondering about, and you seem to be picking up this mantra here, and the question is, as we move forward, do you think there is a way that even electing for anybody or appealing to our representatives can change that? How do you suppose we can change it so that there is a true interest in going back to manufacturing and employing everybody?
Yeah, no, thank you, Bud. We have seen the finance sector, including insurance, go from 4% of our economy to 8% of our economy. It's doubled. The purpose of finance and insurance is to allocate capital and spread risk. And we have turned it instead into a major source of making money rather than making money by creating goods and services for people, products for people. Manufacturing is not going to be the way it was in the past. No two ways about it. Gave the example of the sawmill that's gone from over 200 people down to 8, including the front office. But I think you're going to see more manufacturing done in the U.S. going forward if we have workers for what's called advanced manufacturing. And we will see a lot more wealth created if we can get advanced manufacturing and policies that promote it, and if we invest in the infrastructure that requires it. For example, in 1863, the head of the New York Central Railroad lived in Batavia and came home every weekend, and it took an hour less each direction than it does today. That's absurd. You should be able to get on a train here and be in New York City in no more than 2 hours and therefore eliminate most of the air traffic between those two places. If we build a maglev train, you could be there in 40 minutes. And we should be investing in the things that will make the kind of world that, that China is deeply investing in right now and the kind of manufacturing that brings about. I mean, you go to Singapore and the subways are fabulous and nobody can possibly be killed by the train coming into the station. You go to New York City, there's a couple of people every year that get killed that way.
Our crack connection staff tells me that the film Bud mentioned is Requiem for the American Dream, if you wanted to know about that.
Yeah, Joseph, and I'm not a Chomsky yet, by the way.
Okay, so you want to at least disavow some of that direct comparison.
I have a lot of respect for him, but I'm not a Chomsky yet by any means.
Well, Joseph on Twitter wants to know, he'd like to know what David makes of the uptick in support among the younger generation for socialism, and he refers to a Washington Post article referring to that.
Well, I mean, I think this is a natural reaction to our having gone way overboard in the age of Reagan to the idea that supply-side economics is the solution to our problems. You know, moderation in all things, the Greeks taught us, and we've starved one part of the economy to benefit another, and we've seen this result that when I was a young person, very rich people might own a little jet. Learjets were new. But today we have Americans who, literally, we have an American who owns two personal 747s, and we have all sorts of other people who own personal jumbo jets, and, you know, people who can't count how many mansions they own. And that's the result, I think, not just of people making more money. I want people to make money. I want people to be wealthy. But of government policies that favor certain kinds of activity and allow people like Donald Trump to pay no income taxes legally.
What would you say to younger people that Joseph is referring to who say, but David, I think socialism is the answer?
Well, if you want to have socialism, you want to have democratic socialism, which means you want the private market to make decisions. And then you want rules to protect people.
No,
from
they want socialism.
I don't think they do. From predatory conduct, and you want to have a set of rules that are designed to be balanced and protect people. And this mantra that, you know, every government regulation is bad, nonsense. It's bad for society when we have banking rules of the kind Elizabeth Warren has spent years exposing that damage the economy and profit a few people.
All right, Don in East Rochester, got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, I thank you for taking my call. I just want to emphasize what you said earlier about, say, the sawmill. The people that are laid off from the sawmill due to automation, they are not being able to buy the products that are being produced. If we continue to lower the wages of our workers, we are not going to be able to buy back what is being produced. And when that happens, the recessions and depressions just continue to happen one next to each other. We had four recessions in the 19th century when capitalism was young. We had a few more in the early 20th century, and then it kept picking up and picking up, and now we have about two a decade. This is because the workers cannot buy back the goods and services being produced. Thank you very much.
All right,
the long-term answer to that, though, is that people need to have more skills and better education, and we need to recognize that cutting out art and drama has had a terrible negative effect on our economy. You know, we can't just teach science and math and expect people to get it if we don't teach these other things to create rounded citizens. The economy is going to change, and it's going to continue to change, and you want a dynamic response, and that requires having the most possible education and the broadest possible education, and then you have programs to minimize the damage done to those workers who simply are not going to be able to transit.
Down to our last minute or so, at the beginning of this election campaign, you had a list of, I don't know, 20, 30 questions you wanted the media to ask Donald Trump.
21 questions.
21 questions. In many ways, the media has not done that, and I know you've had some frustration with the media on that. When it comes to wage growth, what do you want the media to do in the way we talk about and report on wage growth in terms of, you know, again, the narrative being that there is none? How do you want that to change? And then what the question is going forward, how do we sustain what we've seen?
Well, first thing I want reporters to do is to get off this narrative there's no wage growth. And I'm the guy, probably more than anybody else in America, when I was at the New York Times, who got this out on the front page year after year after year, showing what was happening. It's changed now. We've made a turn, a big turn. And we need to recognize that we've made a big turn and start acknowledging that. Unemployment's under 5% here in Monroe County. The most recent, I think it's 4.6%. We want to have better jobs. And so we should be talking about what's standing in the way of people having full-time and better jobs. And the number one answer to that is healthcare. Private, you know, job-related healthcare, which began as a tax dodge in an income dodge in World War II. And secondly, we need to recognize that we have to invest in young people and their education. That's absolutely critical, that we've got to improve it. Why are we teaching Elizabethan English in Rochester City schools? It just turns people off. We need to teach instead things that will help people become rounded, mature adults with the ability to adapt to changing economic conditions.
Professor Johnston, you want to give the media a letter grade on how we covered the economy?
C-minus right now.
We'll see. Thank you for being here and for sharing your analysis of wage growth, and learned a lot this hour, as always, from investigative journalist David K. Johnston. Our thanks to all the callers and listeners loaded these 2 hours and got through. You guys always help drive the program, and we appreciate that. We got to as many of you as we could. Catch Wars Engineering, great to have you behind the glass cat. And Megan Mack, the outstanding producer of this broadcast. Thanks to our friends from City 12. Thanks, guys. And thank you for listening. We'll talk with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.